6, Season 3. This is actually Episode 7. Or actually, 7 is this episode. The long and short of it is that I had so much material recorded this week that I literally had to split it up into 2 episodes. So if you were waiting around for a Blender tutorial this week, I don't think anyone really was waiting that much, but in case you were like the one person who really, really needed the Blender tutorial, that's next week. And just to prove that it is actually recorded and everything, I will give you the link so that you can see it online if you absolutely need it now. So go to straightedgelinux.com/videoblender. It's Blender with a capital B. So that's the same address as last tutorial. Down at the bottom of the page of the last tutorial is a link now for the next tutorial on how to export video from Blender. So it's there, it's online, all the screenshots are done. I'm not going to include the audio version of it here because that was just too long to fit into this episode and no one would ever listen to it, much less bother downloading it if it was so huge and so long that, you know, just couldn't listen to it all. So that's been split up, shoved over into episode 07. This week, we're going to talk about 4.1 KDE. We're going to talk about Google Chromium. That is Google Chromium's Linux code that you can go get. So it's actually out for Linux, in spite of what everyone says. So there's that, and there's sudo. A little bit of talk about sudo and POSIX compliance and, quote, correct behavior, unquote. And probably some other stuff. So stay tuned, and let's start the show. Right then, so September 2nd, well, I guess it was maybe at the end, perhaps, of the month, there was a lot of hubbub about Chrome, the new Google browser. And just recently, Peter64 on the Linux Cranks podcast was saying how he was sick and tired of hearing about Chrome, and justly so. I mean, it was at the time a Windows-only application, and it didn't really make a whole lot of sense that everyone was talking about it, except that it is just, you know, geeky news. Interestingly, Google has released the source code. It's called Chromium. That is the open source software project, and people have access to all the source code of Chrome. It is available under a BSD license, and so you could, in theory, compile this for yourself and run it under Linux. You could also, I suppose, compile it for OS X. And I'm sure you can do it for Windows as well. I don't know much about compiling for Windows, but, you know, whatever you need for that, you've got the source code. So it's quite interesting. I imagine that would be a pretty complex compile. I don't think that I would want to embark on that. I also don't think that I really understand anyone's need or desire for a new browser at all. I don't quite get it. Only thing I can think is that maybe Chrome or Chromium improves Google app performance in such a way that, so if you are dropped offline or something, you can continue to work on your project or something like that. So whatever it's got going for it, I guess people are into it. Personally, I don't think I will ever use it. I just have no desire to give myself that completely over to Gmail, to Google, rather. I do use the Gmail account for this podcast, and, you know, I use some of the online apps on occasion to collaborate with people, but all in all, you know, Google seems to be really pretty frightening, so I'm not going to be using it anytime soon, but there you go. It does exist for Linux. It's got the source code. You can go have a look at the code. You can go compile it. All kinds of interesting things. And the source code for that is code.google.com/chromium, which you have to admit is kind of impressive that they're actually using their own code hosting solution. How often have you seen a company using some other solution when they have their own solution? And that always makes me wonder about that company. But here's Google. They've got Chromium, the source code project for Chrome, and it's hosted on Google Code. Got to admit, that's cool. It's even if I don't care about the code, it's nice to see people actually using their own software for things. It's a very good sign for any company that they actually have faith in their own solutions. That's neither here nor there. Code.google.com/chromium. Check it out. Or not. January 17th, 18th, and 19th of this year was the KDE release event in Mountain View at the Google headquarters. I attended and posted a little special podcast from the event location itself. I think I was in a hotel in Campbell, California, actually, which is just a couple miles out of Mountain View. And it was exciting, and they promised many, many great things. And when I installed 4.0, I felt like pretty much everything promised had been delivered. But there was that sense of, there could be more, there could be more. And I have to say that with the release of 4.1, they have met all the promises that they made and exceeded them. 4.1 came to me in an update on my Fedora system. I'm currently attempting to install it on my Slackware system. I'm having some problems with that, which I will not get into right now because no one wants to hear about me compiling 4.1. What people want to hear about is how great 4.1 is. So this came to me via just a standard update on my Fedora system, and it's a wonderful, incredible thing. It is like the desktop of the future. This is a system, I don't know why this is, but I really feel like this is somehow some kind of hybrid between, Fluxbox, something very functional and beautiful like Fluxbox, which I run on my Triple EPC, but it's user, it's more user friendly and more eye candy, like you would get from, for instance, GNOME. So KDE 4.1 looks fantastic. They did a great job of just polishing off a couple of things. Some of the pop-up windows and things like that in 4.0 were fairly large, and that's a complaint that I have about a lot of Linux interface pop-up things and progress bars. For whatever reason, the designers just seem to think that they have to be the width of your thumb in order for you to see them. I have no idea why that is. Even when your screen is set to a high resolution, you seem to be getting these huge windows that take up like a third of your screen. But in 4.1, they've scaled a lot of that stuff down, which is really nice. They've also included some new buttons in the title bars of the windows. Actually one new button, but it's a button to place that window on all desktops, which is very nice. It's very handy. I mean, you can do that with the leftmost icon as well, but it's kind of cool to just have a little button right there to say, yes, sticky, pin this to all desktops. Quite nice. They've given a little bit more definition. There's still a bit of a lack of contrast to it. So if you've got one window on top of another, a lot of times it is kind of hard to distinguish where one ends and where one begins. But like Scarlett said in an HPR episode, all you have to do to fix that is to go to the system settings, which used to be the I guess the K control or control panel or something like that. I don't even remember anymore on 3.5 series. But you go there and you can go to the desktop look and feel of the desktop, and you can enable all your desktop effects. And hey, what a wonderful segue into talking about the all the different effects that 4.1 has in it. So many effects, so many cool effects in 4.1 that you can have, you just wouldn't even believe it. It's an incredible, incredible thing that they've done. A lot of GNOME users, you know, they'll use Compiz, right? And Compiz, you know, I mean, it's got its fair share of trouble sometimes, just depending on what you're using it with and what your system is like. And obviously the same will be true for 4.1. I mean, if you don't have as much video RAM as you should have, the desktop effects are going to cause you problems with certain programs. But overall, I find that these are really well integrated, and so far they seem to be pretty easy to deal with for the system in terms of compatibility with different programs. It's not perfect, so I'm not going to say that it's, you know, flawless. Obviously, if you've got a whole bunch of crazy effects going on your desktop, and you're trying to run something like Blender, where you've got video effects and just all kinds of crazy things going on, and you're doing all this on like an integrated graphics chip on off of your motherboard, yeah, you're going to have some problems. And I say this because that's what I'm doing. But anyway, I mean, you've got a lot of cool things to choose from that I was kind of missing. Having seen them on GNOME with Compiz, I was kind of missing, for instance, the wobbly windows. I like wobbly windows. I really do. I kind of got used to them back when I was playing around with Compiz Fusion, and so I like to have them. And now I can have them. They've got wobbly windows built in, available for 4.1, built into their effects control panel. And they've got shadow that you can add drop shadows, so that helps with contrast. They've got, you know, the exploding windows effects. They've got fades, windows that fall apart, dimming screens, you know, when a pop-up window comes up or a dialog box pops on, it'll dim its parent window, which is great. It's got things to, you know, mouse gestures that you can, you know, put your mouse in a certain corner of the screen and it'll show you all the different windows that you have open and let you switch between them, which I never use, but, you know, it looks cool sometimes. Desktop grid buttons to just, you hit it and it shows you all your desktops. Just all kinds of things, you know, just everything you could possibly want in effects are pretty much there. I don't think that they have the fire effects or anything, but possibly. I mean, you might there's an option to load new ones on, so they might actually have even that kind of stuff. What else do they have going on? Oh yeah, their widgets are, you know, vastly improved and vastly more numerous now, and there is a new button where you can install new widgets from either online, or if you've downloaded it, you need to install it, you can do that. It has something called a dashboard, which I looked at just because I feared what it might be, and I feared correctly. It is just like the dashboard in OS X, where you click it and it takes over your entire desktop and shows you a whole bunch of useless widgets. I think that's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. I can't stand that feature. I can't stand it in OS X, and I can't stand it in KDE 4.1. So if you ever say that I never say anything negative about KDE, that's the thing I would say negative about KDE. That stupid dashboard. It's the worst idea ever. I don't know who... Well, you know, I shouldn't do that, because, I mean, some people probably like it. And someone worked hard making it, and that's neat. But, yeah, I wouldn't use it myself. But they do have a really nice widget where you can show a, well, you've probably already seen this on screenshots. It'll show you, it gives you a view of a certain folder, and you can define what folder the view contains, And then you've got, you know, the icons on your desktop, which everyone was complaining about, oh, I can't have icons on my desktop in KDE, which, again, I love. I mean, this is a feature about KDE and Fluxbox that I consider to be a really good, a strong selling point, because a cluttered desktop is just so easy to acquire, and it just has such a terrible effect on your workflow and on your ability to find stuff and all that other good stuff. So frankly, I don't think that's such a big deal. But for those who do want icons on their desktop, they do have that, so knock yourself out. You can add multiple panels, so the kicker, you can have, you know, as many as you want, really. And there's a really new slick interface for how to configure the kicker. There's a little widget button just on the kicker, so that if you want to add, you know, a task manager and a system panel and a clock and desktop view and application launcher, you can do that from its own little widget panel, which is nice. It's a very, very smart of them to do that. It's much improved, too. The kicker, well, number one, the kicker used to die all the time in 4.0. If you had too many desktop effects going on, it just seemed to not agree with, you know, the plasma of the effects didn't agree with the plasma of the kicker somehow. But now it's much improved. It looks better. It's got a lot more definition to it, you know, a couple more reflections and highlights and things like that. But and it also is very stable. It doesn't start missing chunks out of itself like in 4.0 if you had too many effects going on. The icons are also improved in the kicker. I was finding that, for instance, with Copete, I think it was just Copete, really, but, I mean, some of the icons would just be really, really pixelated in the kicker for some reason. I don't know why. Well, I mean, obviously someone didn't design an icon for that purpose, and it was being blown up. So, that, I mean, that's why, but I don't know. You know, I guess it was because that application hadn't really been ported over to 4.0. But now it has. And that's something that you're going to find in a lot of the different applications. You know, all the K apps are, or at least all the ones that I've used so far, are now truly Qt4 applications, and they look and behave fantastically. They look good. They work better. They look more integrated. They feel more integrated. It's just little things here and there in the various applications that you'll use that really, really help a lot. The menu is even better, actually. They've improved the menu vastly. In 4.0, if you searched your main launcher menu, which is how I usually launch applications, I don't like searching through menus to find the application. So what I would do usually, if I wasn't just hitting Alt F2 to launch it directly, and even if I was, so if I didn't do that, I would go to the application launcher, and there's a search bar right there that basically does the same thing as Alt F2. But even in Alt F2, like in 4.0, if I typed GIMP, it would not find GIMP because there was something in the way that they were treating their metadata, I guess, that you had to type in image. Manipulation or image, and it would find it then. So it was like it was using, for at least GNOME apps, it would use the description of the application instead of the title of the application. It was really strange. I kind of got used to it, but you know, it was annoying. But now they corrected it, and they must be searching for both. For both at the same time. And it's really cool, too. The recently plugged-in devices for systems that have HAL, which the Fedora system does, on it where you can select which device you want to, you know, if it's a mounted device, now you can, there's a little eject button off on the right-hand corner so that you can not only select to go into that device in Dolphin, but you can also just select right there from that little menu to eject it. Previously, you had to go into Dolphin and then click on the device that you want to eject and then eject it. So that's a nice addition. There's a really cool feature in Dolphin now where, I mean, this is so beautiful. I don't know why no one else thought of this. This is one of those things that you're just like, this is progressive computing. I mean, it's so silly and it's so simple. But if you hover over an icon in Dolphin, and I haven't even bothered trying this on Conqueror yet, which I guess is a good thing about Dolphin, because I haven't been using Conqueror quite as much as I was under 4.0. Hover over an icon, and a little plus sign will appear. And you can click the little plus sign, and that's how you can do multiple selections. So if you are using a mouse, and you don't want to take your hand off of your cup of coffee or whatever to hold down the the control key or the shift key or whatever you want to hold down to select multiple items, you can just do it with your mouse now. And that's in both the icon view or the list view. It the same thing happens. It's really clever. I mean, it's like I say, it's super simple. I know it's not that big of a deal, but I mean, that's nice. You know, that's really cool. They did a good job on that. They were really thinking progressively, because no other system that I've seen so far has that. You know, it's just, it's something really simple, but just kind of beautiful. So I'm very impressed with that. And Dolphin in general, I have to say, I'm fairly impressed with Dolphin in general. I mean, it's gotten a lot better. I don't feel like I've given it a run for its money yet. You'll probably hear about it, you know, if I start not liking it. But there's a definite, I will say at least, I'm not going to say that it's perfect and it's everything a file manager should be yet, because I don't know that for sure. But what I will say is that it's much improved. It really did, they took it, or someone took it, and really did, they worked on it, and you can tell. It's a lot snappier, too. It's a lot faster than it used to be, which is really cool. I'm okay with Dolphin for now, at least, for a while. Maybe not forever, but certainly based on a couple of evenings of just light file managing, it's been doing all right. I've been happy with it. That's my review. The widgets look, the plasmoids are looking great, by the way, really. They took away the little translucent border around the plasmoids, and it just kind of, it's got a little tab on it for the controls if you mouse over it, but it doesn't have that weird little border, and they seem to scale better, and just a lot of the controls seem a lot more fluid than they used to be. Really fantastic, impressive little desktop environment. It is a really slick desktop environment. So if you're curious about KDE, and you haven't completely discounted me yet as just a total KDE fanboy, because I'm not a total KDE fanboy, because I did have that one bad thing to say about it, plus I do use other desktop environments. So, you know, you can kind of somewhat listen to me as if though I had some element of non-biased opinion to me. Not much, but a little bit. So, give that a shot if you're curious about it. You want to see kind of how it goes, and check it out. It's a nice environment. It really is. So, you know, well done, KDE team, and. It's only going to get better from here. It's really exciting. That's it. Sounds to me like it's time for a coffee break. So I'm going to go grab a cup of coffee, and you can go do the same. And then we'll continue right after this message.
Ohio Linux Fest, the Midwest's best free and open source software conference. In Columbus, Ohio, October 10th and 11th. www.ohiolinux.org.
Okay, so this is a very esoteric, geeky kind of discussion, and I apologize if this just makes no sense or is boring, but this is the kind of thing that really fascinates me. Okay, so first, preamble, POSIX, right? POSIX stands for Portable Operating System maybe interface or something. I don't know, something. But that's what it stands for, more or less, and the idea is that it's a standardized set of guidelines on how an operating system that you may be designing or setting up for yourself, for instance, if you're doing Linux from scratch or something, you might want to keep in mind certain POSIX guidelines. Or if you're programming, you would want to keep in mind POSIX guidelines. And ideally, this is supposed to be so that if I go from an OS X box to a Solaris box to a Linux box, they all act and behave pretty much the same way. And if I go to take a portable application that was written for, you know, Unix, and I compile it on Linux and then compile it on Solaris and then on OS X, it compiles. Now, I know for a fact that sounds great, and it is just, it's sometimes very, very rare. If you go and download the source code for something that you are using on Linux and you try to install it on a Mac that you have gotten, maybe because you work at a place that uses Macs all the time and you don't really have much of a choice, you try to compile it on there, it's not always going to just magically compile. Sometimes there's a lot of stuff that you have to do. I mean, aside from setting up your environment on OS X because it's not developer ready out of the box, but I mean, just in terms of literally porting the application, you know, from if it was written with Linux in mind, porting it to the Mac, it's a serious deal. So it sounds good, doesn't always quite happen. But in terms of, like, the operating system design, I guess, generally speaking, they try to keep things, you know, quote, POSIX compliant. And one of the things that OS X did when they released their 10.5 version, Leopard, they paid or bribed or just did whatever they had to do to be POSIX certified, meaning that they were compliant with everything that POSIX said that needed to happen for a, you know, a quote POSIX compliant operating system. And they touted that and really, you know, trumpeted that as something significant, something that even benefited the greater open source community, things like that. So Mac OS X, they've got POSIX down, and they're adhering to it strictly. So this is an interesting thing, because there are the way that sudo and su behave between different Unix systems seems to be kind of interesting in its differences. And this is something that I would love to hear feedback about. If you've got some thoughts on it, I think I know why the difference is happening. But let me run you through a simple little test that you can try on your system. And I will say that I have tested it on Ubuntu, because Ubuntu does the same kind of thing as OS X, where they set their first user up to be the sudo enabled user, and the any user that you create thereafter do not have sudo permission. They would have to first su into the administrative user. Let's just call that first user the admin, and then they could sudo from there. So I'm doing it on Ubuntu and OS X, just to compare the two systems. Let's start with OS X. PWD, okay, we're in users/clatu. SU-admin, okay, we're switching user to admin, and we have the dash in there to carry over the environment with us. Put in our password, PWD now, and we get /users/admin. And I'm saying /users, I'm not misspeaking. In OS X, it's /users with a capital U, it's not /home with a lowercase h, it's /users/admin. All right, so now we've got, we're the admin, we have admin privs, we are not root, okay? So now we cd into /users/clat2, pwd, yep, we're in /users/clat2. The default permissions on a user's home directory is 755, so that would be the user can do anything they want, and then the group and the others can read and execute. Now let's cd into downloads, into documents. Permission denied. Well, that's because we're admin trying to cd into clat2's documents. We don't have permission to do that. All right, now let's sudo cd into documents. Here's where it gets interesting. We do that, we don't get any feedback on the process. We do a pwd, and we discover that /users/clat2. So we didn't get into the documents folder. Even though it didn't tell us we weren't allowed in there, we didn't get in there. And in fact, I believe that we did. I think you're in documents for like a millisecond. Because basically what's happening is that you're sudo cd documents, and then immediately after the command is executed, you lose the sudo privs, and you're dumped back out into users/clat2. Now, that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me that way, but it does. That would seem to be what is going on. And you can do something interesting. You can sudo bash, and that will open up a root shell, and then you can cd into documents, pwd, and lo and behold, you're in /users/clat2/documents. And again, the reason is because the root shell is not exiting the folder immediately after executing its command. It's now an open shell, and you can go into different places, and you're root, basically. I believe possibly the reason that they're doing this is because of a security concern, because it would seem like maybe they compiled sudo with like a zero timeout or something like that, you know? Because if you go to the sudo website and you read up on the sudo command itself, the sudo program, you can change the timeout length after, you know, during compile. The default is 5 minutes, and it seems to me like what's going on here is that the sudo command in OS X is timing out immediately after it is run, so that you can basically invoke sudo to do things like removing, you know, system files and things like that, where it runs the command and then it's gone. But you're seeing that you're not able to traverse the file system with the sudo command, even though under more traditional, I shouldn't say traditional, but other Unix-like systems, it does not behave this way. And I think from the sudo website, at least, it seems like it's not meant to work that way. I can't find out whether that's a POSIX rule or not, and I'm kind of assuming that maybe it is, but it seems to me like that sudo has been changed specifically at compile time to time out very, very immediately. Now, to get an idea of what would happen on a similar system, on a Unix-like system, let's flip over to Ubuntu. Now, in Ubuntu, if you do the exact same string of commands, obviously with the exception that /users/clat2 would be /home/clat2, you do the exact same stuff. When you sudo cd into documents, you're going to end up in documents. It will dump you into documents, and you will be there, and you can look around, and you can do whatever you need to do for 5 minutes. So you have that sudo power for 5 minutes, just like the sudo website says you do. So who's right, who's wrong? I don't know. Is there a right, is there a wrong? I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's going to be down to number one, does anyone even realize that this is happening, you know, I mean, like, did someone flip a switch intentionally, or did someone not flip a switch intentionally? Are we saying that POSIX is the one that is, quote, right, unquote? What does POSIX even say? Are they saying, yes, do 5-minute timeout like the default sudo, or do a 0 timeout for security purposes, or do we even care? Maybe we don't even care about POSIX because what's another standards group, right? So who knows? It's something to play around with, see what your system does. And if you know anything more about POSIX than I do, let me know. And certainly if you know anything more about sudo than I do, let me know. Their website, I would love to tell you, except that my internet is down right now. My internet service is not working. But if you do a Google search for sudo, official website or something, you'll get there where the actual program exists from which, you know, all the Unix-like systems take it if they want it. And of course there are systems like Fedora that don't even use the sudo command at all. You just su into root. So it just depends on what kind of system you're running and what you like best. A lot of people have a lot of problems with sudo because it does kind of shoot a hole in the whole root versus user separation idea. And I imagine that might be why one system is saying, okay, we're going to shut this off after 1 millisecond, and one system is saying, oh, we'll give privs for a good 5 minutes just to prevent someone from accidentally leaving themselves in root, but at least they'll have a good 5 minutes to play around in. There you go. That's about as detailed and geeky as I can get. Hope you enjoyed it. Production company that I was working with on a project was using a .Mac account system to share files back and forth. One of the things that they had to do quite frequently was send the sound mixers audio files that were very, very large, and the way that they decided to do this was via the Apple .Mac service, which is just Apple's WebDAV, you know, basically it's just a server, it's cloud computing, you upload your file to the Apple server, and someone else on a Mac or a Windows PC is able to log into the account and grab the files off. It wasn't terribly fast, wasn't terribly different really in any way than just a normal FTP server, really, and I was trying to tell the company that it might be a good idea to just go over to a normal FTP server, but that was just too much for them. They, you know, the Mac solution had the advantage of being built into the operating system. It is clearly discouraged on the Mac OS to use the FTP solution because there's simply no easy way to access an FTP server. There's a way that you can read and download from an FTP server, although it is kind of a frightening procedure. It's not quite as friendly as the .Mac, the iDisk procedure, where it's in a menu. It says go to an iDisk. In this, you have to connect to server, and then you have to put in this the whole line, and you have to know what the prefix is, and, you know, people get confused what exactly they're supposed to be entering, and do you enter the username or just the address, and, you know, stuff like that. So, short story, they didn't want to do the FTP thing. They stuck with the .Mac. Interesting thing happened when Apple switched over from their trademark .Mac product to their trademark Mobile Me service. One thing they did was they increased the storage space that people got on their, quote, iDisks. That's a trademark. And they also broke the whole service, just completely broke everything. And nothing worked. I had told them to go to FTP, and now they were sitting there with broken services that they had really come to rely on, and they were in trouble for a while. And all of that has nothing to do with this segment at all. That was just kind of a fun story that I wanted to relate to you. The actual point of all this was that because I was working with this film company, actually, it does not, you know, that's not true. It does have something to do with the segment. So I was working with that film company, and so they had assigned me a an iDisk, a .Mac account, an iDisk. So I had initially, I think, 1 gig, and then they upped it to 10 gigs. And then, like I say, when they switched over to MobileMe, they gave everyone 20 gigs, 20 gigabytes of online space. Well, since at the point of the flipping the switch from .Mac to MobileMe, this film company finally said, okay, Klaatu, you're right. We need to get off this service because it isn't reliable. And we didn't really ever like it anyway. So now they are using an FTP service. They're just doing, and Firefox 3, by the way, has great FTP support. It really is very cool. I had actually shown them a different program, a little freeware app for the Mac, but since then, Firefox 3 has blown me away. And I know you're thinking, oh yeah, well, there's that Fire FTP or whatever. Well, there isn't even that. I mean, there is that, but that even that has, you know, the whole two windows within Firefox window. That scares people. They don't understand that stuff. What you can do in Firefox, if you want to view an FTP server, you simply type it in. You probably already know that. FTP:// you know, thebadapples.info. Okay, then it drops down a little dialogue and asks you for the name and the password. You put in the name, Klaatu, the password, Klaatu. Ha, just kidding. And then you you can look and you can download files. No problem. It's very friendly. People like Firefox. They're used to it. It's quite nice. Now, if they need to upload, there's a program in there's a add-on to Firefox that you can download or that you can install in Firefox, and it will give you the ability to upload a file to an FTP server. And it is called simply, now I'm looking for it, FTP upload. And I will try to have a link in the show notes to that so that you can actually maybe go there and download it. But all it does is it puts a little upload file into your file menu. And if you're in an FTP, if you're at an FTP site, you've signed in, you now have an option in your file menu to upload a file. It's all very friendly, especially for users that just do not want to have to deal with FTP, don't understand what the difference between FTP and HTTP and WebDAV is. So it's really nice. All right, so that was a bonus tip right there. I wasn't actually going to talk about the Firefox FTP support, but that is nice. Now, what I was going to talk about was this 20 gigs of space, server space that I have and have nothing to do with, because this film production company is not going to be using it anymore. They've switched over completely to FTP, but I still have the account, and as far as I know, I'm going to have the account for a number of years because they got this huge package when they first invested in the whole setup. So I've got 20 gigs of space, and yes, it's on a WebDAV server, and yes, it's on Apple servers, I guess, but it's got friendly friendly URLs that you can link to directly, and I really want to put something up here that's of use. So I contacted the 64 Studio distribution because I know that they had a very sort of easy to mirror release folder. And so I grabbed all their images and put them in the WebDAV space. I'm mirroring Mepis, simply Mepis, and I'm only doing that because they had really simple sort of release folder to mirror. And I've tried them out and I liked them, so I just figured why not. And I'm also mirroring Dynabolic because again, I mean they have like one release, so I downloaded that release and posted it. I am mirroring some video tutorials on Blender. They're not my video tutorials. They're, I think, maybe official video tutorials from the Blender site, mainly on like the interface and like the 3D modeling and stuff, which I'm going to watch those pretty soon to try to get more familiar with the whole 3D aspect of Blender. But I've still got space, and I would just love to mirror something. So, and I don't know if it can be a true mirror, like with an rsync script set up and stuff like that. I mean, I really doubt it, because this is WebDAV. It's not my personal server, but it is empty space. It's online. It could maybe relieve some download burden off of some project out there. So if you know of any project out there that needs to be that needs space on a server, let me know. Just email me, and we can set that up. We can post their stuff on the server space. There's a public folder there for it, so it can just be there, and they can link directly to that. People don't really ever have to know too much that it's an Apple server. But there you go. I don't know how fast it is. I know that it does have a lot of bandwidth per month permitted. So it's definitely something, you know, to look into. If you know of a project, then email me. Now, if you just can think of a project, don't bother emailing me. I can think of a lot of projects as well. The hard part seems to be getting in touch with these projects, rather getting in touch with someone who, you know, is kind of in charge of the mirroring aspect. You know, I mean, it's easy enough to post this stuff. I mean, I've got the Studio 64, I've got the Dynabolic, I've got Mepis, and I've emailed these projects and told them, hey, I'm mirroring your stuff, but so far no links have appeared on their sites to that mirror. So I don't know if they just don't think that mirror is going to be fast enough for them to really mention the link, or whether they're just busy, and probably they're just busy because they're working hard on a lot of other stuff. So it would be better, I think, if you not only knew of a project, but actually could, you know, if you know someone associated with a project, so that we can actually get the link out there, so that people actually know that these files exist on this server, so that they can use that bandwidth instead of, you know, someone else's bandwidth. That's the idea. So there you go. That's what I have to offer right now. Some free space online, ready to be hit with some downloads. Well, I think that about wraps up the show for now. I hope some of this was interesting. And if you want to email me, it's gort.klaatu@gmail.com. That is gort.klaatu@gmail.com. Website's thebadapples.info. That is thebadapples.info. And thanks for listening. And check back next week for what would really be part, you know, 06.5 or something like that. It's got all the other stuff that I recorded for this episode that just was too long to fit into this episode. Blender tutorial. I mean, it's already edited and everything. I could just double post this week, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to draw it out so that you can just have to wait for a whole week. But there's some good stuff in that episode, so check back next week.